Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, Donald Trump gave his first speech to a joint session of Congress. He talked about deregulation, the construction of the Keystone XL and Dakota Access oil pipelines, construction of the wall, and repealing the Affordable Care Act. He called undocumented immigrants a security threat after telling the stories of two people in the chamber whose relatives were killed by immigrants. Donald Trump ran a campaign based on the vilification of undocumented immigrants, fear, xenophobia, and racism. A lot of people are still asking, how did he manage to win the election and reach the White House? How did the media shape the public's attitude toward his candidacy and now his presidency? In his new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus, today's guest, Rolling Stone reporter Matt Taibbi, details the reasons for Donald Trump's victory. He writes, quote, "During most of the last 2 years, I thought the Trump campaign would just be an isolated episode of mass insanity on which we would someday be able to look back and laugh. It turned out to be something a lot darker and crazier than that," end quote. Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist with Rolling Stone. He covered the 2016 election for the magazine and traveled extensively with the Trump campaign. Matt is the author of several books. His latest is called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. And Matt Taibbi joins us on the line from Jersey City. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
How are you doing, Rose?
Good. Thank you for joining us. I want to start off by asking you about what happened last night, and especially the media coverage. The New York Times and Reuters headlines were about how Donald Trump softened his tone. So many outlets are focusing on that. But the content of his speech was about more policing. He talked about undocumented immigrants. He told the stories of two people in the chamber whose relatives were killed by immigrants. He said, "As we speak, we're removing gang members, drug dealers, criminals that threaten our communities and prey on our citizens." He delivered a hyper-nationalist and patriotic speech of America First. What are your thoughts about how the media are covering this?
I'm a little bit surprised by the coverage. I was especially surprised by the New York Times piece that way up top gave him credit for sort of civility and accepting the traditions and restrictions of the checks and balances system. And in other words, they took his speech at face value. Whereas we have enough experience with Donald Trump now to know that his pattern is to swing wildly between different moods and different modes. He is unreasonable at some times, he says outrageous things at others, and then just when you think that you have him pegged, he'll turn around and do a complete 180, and he'll say something that reassures people. And it surprises me that the New York Times, you know, just a few days after Donald Trump is calling them the enemy of the people and kicking them out of a gaggle in the White House, that they're taking this at face value. It just shows that they're still not caught up to his act.
Hmm. How are you going to, or how would you cover his speech last night?
Well, I think at this point, you try not to follow Donald Trump's rhetorical flourishes as much. This is one thing that I've learned over the last couple of years, and I have to admit, you know, a lot of the things that Trump does and says are so crazy and so newsworthy and so hard not to comment on that it's hard not to pay attention to all the different things that he does and says. But what you really have to do is follow what his concrete actions are. What are his policy decisions? Who is he actually naming to his, you know, to his cabinet, to federal posts? And what is the consistent message overall? And if you look at Trump's inauguration speech, the one thing that I think and you mentioned this that has been consistent throughout is this whole message of this nationalistic message of America First. And he delivered that at the CPAC convention last week. So when he's at a friendly audience and versus a mixed audience, he says the same thing, that the substance of his administration is that we are going to take care of American citizens first, and we are not going to worry about people in foreign countries, and we're going to reject globalism. And I think that's the main message.
Let's talk a little bit about immigration, because you write about this in your book. And last night, he announced the creation of this organization called Voice. This is going to be an agency that will publish a list of crimes committed by immigrants.
Right.
Can you talk about what he did last night in acknowledging these people in the chamber whose relatives were killed by immigrants? And just, you know, he launched his campaign by saying that Mexicans are rapists and criminals. He said, when Mexico sends in people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're sending people with a lot of problems. They're rapists. Some are good people, but they're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. So talk a little bit about just his policy on immigrants, from that launching the campaign by saying that to this creation of this new agency.
Yeah, I mean, this new agency is unbelievable, and it's incredible that people haven't noticed. You know, this is something that's taken straight out of the playbook, and you hate to violate Godwin's law and go there, but the Nazis did this, and the Nazi Institute for the Research on the Jewish Question started this policy of keeping lists committed by of crimes committed by Jews. That was one of the very first things in the early part of Hitler's tenure that he did. So this, you know, it's obviously a rhetorical publicity stunt that he's doing that's highly effective, and it's very similar to what he did, as you mentioned, at the outset of his campaign, when he came out with that message about how Mexicans aren't bringing their best people and they're bringing rapists and so on. You know, clearly there's no evidence whatsoever that immigrants commit crimes at a higher rate than the rest of the population. In fact, it's actually the opposite. But it's been an extremely successful line of sort of political rhetoric that he's pursued since he's become a candidate, and it's been what separated him in a lot of ways from the rest of the Republican field. He's willing to go so much farther in that direction that's really what won him the nomination, I think.
And you were at a lot of the rallies when he talked about immigrants. What was the reaction of the people in the crowd, and did you ever interview them specifically about his comments on immigrants?
I did, and a lot of the things that people said about that, there were some people. Let me back up for a minute and just say that the Trump's crowds were a mixture. They were very eclectic. You know, there was obviously a group that you found pretty regularly. They were these kind of racial holy war, sort of neo-Nazi types. There were a few of those at almost every rally, but by and large, the overwhelming majority of people that you met weren't overt racists. They weren't they weren't neo-Nazis. They weren't even alt-righters, because the sort of alt-right contingent was mainly made up of these sort of college-educated campus conservative types, and those weren't the people you saw at his speeches by and large either. It was mostly the kind of Nixonian silent majority voters who, in the past, you know, would have been Reagan Republicans, but now they were speaking a new language, in large part thanks to Trump. They were openly rejecting what they described as a kind of globalist conspiracy against American workers, and they tied the things that Trump was saying about immigrants to their disdain over Democratic policies on things like trade and NAFTA. Mm-hmm. This is all connected to the whole sort of problem of what's going on economically in middle America. And Trump, I think, very cleverly and very effectively wove all of those passions together to get those votes.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi about his new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt Taibbi writes for Rolling Stone, and he was with the Trump campaign when they were on the road during the election season. And Matt, you've got some just really interesting insights about just how the media cover these campaigns, about Washington. I mean, we're out here in the West Coast and pretty disconnected from Washington. But tell us a little bit about some of the journalists that you were side by side with during this campaign, and just how they cover these campaigns. You write that stuck inside the campaign bubble for too long, politicians and journalists alike started to operate like high school heathers, using abuse and shaming to enforce the myriad social rules inside the plane. If candidate A fell outside either behavioral or policy lines, 50 reporters immediately cried foul, and that candidate quickly retreated or else. So talk a little bit about how journalists cover these campaigns.
Yeah, so I mean, this was my fifth presidential campaign that I've covered, so I've had a lot of time, and unlike newspaper reporters who have to file every day or television reporters who have to do hits every 20 or 30 minutes, you know, as a magazine writer, I had a lot of downtime over those years where I just sort of kind of sat and watched how the process works and how people cover campaigns. And one of the problems is that the atmosphere behind the rope line, you know, what Tim Krause once called, you know, the boys in the bus, the group of sort of politicians, their aides, and the reporters who travel on the plane from town to town, they are a completely isolated community. In fact, once the Secret Service gets involved, you literally can't break containment when you go from place to place without getting permission. So it's like a roving prison. You're stuck with the same people over and over and over again, day after day, week after week. And what happens is people start to, like as you quoted, they start to adopt each other's values. They stop being able to communicate or accurately perceive the point of view of people outside the plane. And that's one of the things that happened with Donald Trump. Trump was tuned into things that people, the reporters and the politicians, were not tuned into because they had spent too much time with each other. Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing that you mentioned about reporters shaming people, one of Trump's great early triumphs was that he survived when reporters tried to wipe him out after the McCain episode, where he said he didn't like people who were captured. And reporters kind of rolled out the same script they had done with Howard Dean and Gary Hart and, you know, God knows whoever else, you know, had crossed them in the past. And we pigpiled on him, and he didn't go away. And people love that. They love the idea that he rejected the notion that the press get to choose who got to run and who didn't.
And as you write in your book, you write about that Howard Dean scream and how TV stations around the country played the scream a whopping 633 times in the first 4 days after Iowa, according to the Associated Press.
Right, yeah. And so I had a friend who I met in Iowa, who was also a reporter, who kind of jokingly described this process as the seal of death. So when... once the candidate did something or crossed the line somehow, and, you know, Dean's scream, in hindsight, of course, looks pretty innocuous, but Dean's problem was that he had already sort of violated a lot of the rules of the orthodoxy inside the plane. He was anti-war. He was getting his funding from the wrong people. In other words, he was soliciting individual donations in small amounts on the internet as opposed to getting them from the usual corporate sources. So people like him and Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich and Bernie Sanders this year, they're sort of already outsiders. They're not the cool kids on the plane. Mm-hmm. And whenever there's an excuse, whenever one of those people screws up, that's when we pile on that person and we do this sort of seal of death script where we replay their faults over and over and over again. And usually they go away after that and they quit the race. But Trump didn't, and he continued to not do it after each one of his episodes, and people loved him for it because he was defying sort of conventional wisdom.
And are we talking about broadcast media and the major newspapers?
Yes.
These are the media outlets that consistently travel with the presidents or the presidential hopefuls.
Yeah, and that's a really key point, because one of the things that most people don't know is that it costs thousands of dollars a day to be part of that traveling press contingent. If you want to be on the plane with a major party candidate and be on that charter plane, eat that catered food, and stay at the same hotels the candidate's staying at, you know, the bill that I had for my last trip with Trump was something like $12,000 for 3 days.
Oh, wow.
So it totally excludes the alternative media. The only people who can afford to travel with the campaigns are part of these sort of gigantic corporate for-profit news agencies, and so that instantly eliminates a certain kind of thinking from inside the plane. And that's one of the reasons why they're so simpatico with the sort of beltway politicians who they're traveling with, because they're essentially class-wise the same people.
Well, and talk a little bit more about that, because when I watch the coverage, I often think this is a great opportunity to let the public know about what this area is like. What is the poverty rate like? What is the average wage like? Talk to people about their plight. Do they have a good job? Does their kid go to a good school? Do they have health care? And that never comes across. I mean, I can't imagine one of these reporters going to a food bank or a shelter to find out what's really happening on the ground. But why not? I mean, do you ever ask these reporters why they don't leave and go find out what's really happening on the ground?
I have asked that question. And in fact, one of the first times I did this gig was on the plane with Kerry, and I started to ask some of those exact questions that you're asking. You know, how come we never, you know, we're always telling the same cliches and we're always reporting from the same angle, and et cetera, et cetera. And the word got around that I was asking people on the record about the job, and I was immediately reassigned to the back of the plane. So I was sitting next to photographers for the rest of the trip.
Wow.
But that's okay. But look, there are logistical things that make it difficult to do what you're talking about, because you're only in these places for, you know, an hour and a half at a time. And by the end of the campaign, or at least previously, you know, the candidates would hit three or four cities a day. So you're not really getting a chance to engage people and find out what they're really thinking and how they're living. That's the excuse later. What I always thought is, especially with Iowa and New Hampshire, where you can be there for days or months at a time, you know, you really have an opportunity to learn what's going on out there, and people don't do it. They consistently don't. They go to these events, which essentially could be done in a soundstage. You don't even have to really be in the state. They could just change the audience and continue to do these sort of canned events over and over again. But I try not to do that. I try to do things like go to, drug recovery centers and food banks like you're talking about, and, you know, talk to people who are unemployed and, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But you don't really get, if you're just doing it the standard issue campaign reporting, it's almost impossible to do.
And it's interesting, because now the media are obsessed with Trump voters. And what we're getting is a lot of, in some cases, very shallow sound bites. I mean, you don't really learn about who these people are other than a sound bite.
That's right. Yeah. No, and it's heavily caricaturized. People come in with preconceptions about, you know, what kind of a person votes for Donald Trump. Whereas, you know, in reality, everybody's different. It's really difficult to sort of place everybody in just a couple of categories, but that's what they do. And I think one of the reasons that they do that is that, again, all these people who are in the plane, they rely on each other for information about what's going on, quote unquote, out there. But they're also relying on pollsters. And pollsters tell them a lot, and they tell them, you know, what percentage of people are favoring this candidate or that candidate, what certain attitudes are. You often hear lines like 67% of people want to go in a new direction irrespective of what the new direction is. But all that data is great, but it doesn't really tell you a whole lot qualitatively. Like, you know, the difference between mere rejection of the Democrats and rage is a huge difference, and you can't get that without personally talking to people. And that's one of the things that's happened in the last 15 to 20 years, is that there's been this distance between reporters and voters. They increasingly rely on electronic solutions to find out what's going on out there, as opposed to just individually talking to people.
Today we're speaking with Matt Taibbi about his new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt Taibbi has covered 5 presidential races. Is that right, Matt? Did you say five? Five. Wow.
Yep.
And he was extensively traveling with the Trump campaign. He writes about the way that the media cover these elections. And he also writes about how he and so many people got it wrong. If you have any questions for Matt Taibbi about covering politics, what really happens in Washington, he's got also some really interesting quotes from congressional staffers about how Washington works. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you make of media coverage of Donald Trump, and also the way that the Democrats are or are not talking about why they lost not only the presidency, but across the country. They're continuing to lose in states across the country. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website or social media. Matt, it was interesting to read some of your columns from last year where you talk a lot about Donald Trump because you cover him, but you end a lot of your columns by saying, you know, this guy is not going to win, but still, this is so frightening. There are so many layers to why Donald Trump won the election, but as you reflect back and you've had time now to really think about it, what are two of the reasons at the top of your list?
Wow. Well, it's a complicated question, but I would say a lot of the things that we were talking about are the primary reason. Donald Trump, his primary sales pitch to people was that he was a traitor to a class of elitists who were engaged in a conspiracy against the ordinary working person, and that he, Donald Trump, was going to come down from the Olympus and right all of these wrongs, and he was the person to do it because he knew how the system works, because he had been part of that tribe, and he was now going to defy them and right all those wrongs. And the reason, one of the reasons that he was able to do that, and of course on the surface it's preposterous because Donald Trump is a billionaire, he's been handed everything he ever needed in life, he's probably never really had a substantive relationship with the kind of people who voted for him, but he was able to effectively portray himself as a friend of the common man. And one of the reasons he was able to do that, I think, was because of his portrayal as somebody who was being sort of crucified by the media. The media solved his accessibility problem. We turned into the symbols of the elitist conspiracy, and whenever we wrote anything negative about him, Trump held it up as proof that he was on their side. And I think that was an enormous factor. That and the fact that he manipulated the commercial weaknesses of the media to win himself probably over $1 billion of free coverage, especially in the early stages of the campaign when candidates normally have to buy their own airtime. Trump, you know, was a Super Bowl every single day on cable news, and he never had to do anything for PR. He got all of it for free from us.
And he made them a lot of money and continues to make them a lot of money.
Yes. Yep.
We have a question from a caller about that. Let's hear from Peter in Oakland. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Peter.
I've watched politics pretty intensely for 50 years, and I've never seen anything remotely to compare with the domination of the airwaves that this guy got. Mm-hmm. Just what you're saying. I mean, from the standpoint of an observer, he got 3 or 4 times as much coverage as all the other candidates put together for the first, 3 or 4 months of the campaign. And after a while I was saying, okay, the guy's got extensive connections with these channels. He has successful TV shows. He knows how the system works. Why was nobody kind of noticing this is anything but a fair democratic comparison of people during a campaign? I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure. Yeah, Peter, thanks. That's a great question. In fact, it's worse even than you described. I mean, if you just compare it to the amount of coverage that he got to that of Bernie Sanders, who was a almost exactly similar news story in a lot of respects. He was leading a successful revolt against his own party. He got 23 times the amount of television coverage that Sanders did in the first 6 months of the campaign, according to one study that I read. So, the reason for that is really simple. Trump was making these companies money. He made them an enormous amount of money, and Rose, as you mentioned, he continues to do it. Since the election, the ratings, which typically plummet for news channels after a presidential election is over, they are skyrocketing. CNN is up 51% in the 25 to 54 bracket. Fox is up 50%. MSNBC is up 30% in the ratings. CNN projects to make $1 billion this year. So after decades of seemingly inexorable decline in the media business, where both newspapers and, incidentally, the New York Times got 132,000 new subscribers in the first 18 days after the election, which is 10 times the amount over the last year. So even newspapers, which are a dying industry, are starting to make money. And so if you're looking for why everybody's covering Donald Trump, it's not a mystery. It's because Donald Trump has turned the White House into the world's most profitable reality show, and he is allowing a dying industry to recover, and that's why.
And in your book, you write that a news director who made the decision to run a Bernie Sanders speech in its entirety would worry about being accused of making a political statement. Meanwhile, running Donald Trump all day long would be understood as just business, just giving viewers what they want. Editorially, the press denounced Donald Trump, but it never turned the cameras off.
Right, yeah. And this is not... It has nothing to do with whether or not this is fair or democratic or anything like that. It's just the kink of our system. We have a commercial media system. In the old days, you know, going back to the 40s and 50s after the Telecommunications Act of the 30s, companies essentially understood their news programs to be loss leaders, that the whole idea was that the government would lease the airwaves to these companies in exchange for the companies doing a public service. So they were supposed to think in a civic manner when they were constructing their news programs. That's just not true anymore. Beginning in the 80s and 90s, these companies, and especially after the sort of innovation of Fox News, which was such an overtly commercial enterprise, we think of news as needing to make money. And as a result, the Trump was just an irresistible phenomenon to news networks.
Matt Taibbi is author of the new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt is a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, and he's covered 5 elections. He traveled extensively with the Trump campaign, and he writes about how the media covered the campaign and how so many people got this election so wrong. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. And you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about how organizations and society, all of us, can give boys a better path to address the realities they face in a changing society and economy. We're going to talk about growing up in this hyper-masculine society and what organizations are doing to reach out to boys. And also teachers. This is a really important topic. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're speaking with Matt Taibbi, contributing editor with Rolling Stone. He's out with a new book called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Like so many, Matt Taibbi did not think Donald Trump would win. He covered him extensively. He was on the road with Donald Trump. He's got a lot of insights about how the media cover presidential elections. He also talks to congressional staffers about what really happens in Washington, D.C. If you have any questions or comments for Matt, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to ask you about the populism that we heard and continue to hear from Donald Trump and how the media covered that. You write that in the end, Trump's populism was as fake as everything else about him. He emerged as just another in a long line of Republican hacks, only dumber and less plausible to the political center. When we finally, the media, pulled the lid off the guy, there was nothing there, just a cheap fraud and TV huckster who got in way over his head and will now lead his hoodwinked followers off the cliff of history. But Matt, I receive emails from some listeners who said, you know what? The Democrats have failed us on neoliberalism. And Donald Trump has talked about the fact that so many jobs have been sent overseas, that people are living in poverty. I mean, you did not hear that from Barack Obama. He talked about how the economy came back, people are working again, never talked about the fact that so many of these jobs are part-time with no benefits.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The passage that you quoted that I'm very embarrassed by now, because actually early in the campaign, I was listening to Trump's message on things like NAFTA and globalism, and I could see that it was extremely effective. And what I was responding to in that particular moment was that was his convention speech, when he seemed to go away from a lot of those themes, and I thought that was going to cost him in the end. As you say, Trump spoke to people about issues that they had not heard from either party for ages. When he would go before crowds, he would talk about how both parties had essentially been appropriated by the same commercial interests. They were dominated by the same insurance companies. They wouldn't give up the antitrust exemption for health insurance because they were both taking money from the same pharmaceutical companies. And over and over and over again, he would hammer these themes and talk about things that you never heard about, like, for instance, that Jeb Bush was getting his money from the same places that the Democratic candidates had been getting their money over the years. And all of this resonated with people, and I talked to a lot of people who, including many who used to be Democrats or union members, who said, I don't buy the Democratic solution anymore because they've shipped my job overseas. And look, that's not a majority of Trump's voters, but it was a sizable portion. It definitely mattered that he did that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when MSNBC had a town hall with Bernie, and a number of Trump voters said if they had the choice, they would have voted for Bernie Sanders.
Absolutely, yeah, no, and like, I really like Bernie Sanders. I'm not, I have known him for a long time, but that's not why I think he would have won if he was the candidate. What convinced me that Sanders probably would have had a better chance was that I kept hearing over and over again exactly that when I talked to Trump supporters. A lot of them said things like, well, he's a communist and a socialist, but I like him. He's honest.
Wow.
And so that whereas the response to Hillary Clinton was very different.
And Matt, before we get back to phone calls, just on this populist message, Donald Trump now has billionaires and millionaires in key positions, people who don't believe in the very government agencies they're running, like Scott Pruitt, for example, with the EPA. But we're talking the Treasury Secretary. Those guys are billionaires and millionaires. Public Citizen says that this has been a massive corporate takeover of U.S. government, unlike anything we've ever seen. So you have Trump saying that people are living in poverty, and they are, and people cannot find jobs, and that is true. But then you look at the people who's running his government and some of the things that we know he's going to do. How would you analyze that and whether or not these people are actually going to see improvements in their lives?
Well, so it's very difficult to parse the, his populism, because on the one hand, I remember very vividly listening to Donald Trump in person denounce Goldman Sachs, denounce Ted Cruz for having ties to Goldman Sachs, denounce Hillary Clinton for it. And then, of course, what does he do after he becomes president? He's already got half a dozen bankers from Goldman Sachs in his government, including three of his top advisors, Steve Bannon and Steve Mnuchin, for instance, and Gary Cohn, his National Economic Council chief. They're all from Goldman. Cohn, was the number two guy at Goldman and is pointedly a pro globalism kind of figure who was very much against Brexit. So on the one hand, Trump has brought in some people who have been critical of globalism and critical of the free trade policies, like Wilbur Ross, But on the other hand, he's got all these people from these investment banks who have been the primary beneficiaries of the very policies that he's been denouncing. So it's tough to really figure out where he is on any of this. My suspicion is that that he's brought in just enough people to convince that his supporters that that he is real on some of these populist themes.
I'm talking with Matt Taibbi today. He's author of the new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt is contributing editor for Rolling Stone. He's covered five presidential elections and extensively traveled with the Trump campaign and the media press corps, who also covered the campaign. Let's go to Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess, well, first of all, I want to say that I completely agree with you, the media having fallen down. I mean, I, as a KPFA reporter, was at the Bernie rally here in Oakland, and I couldn't be more shocked at how blasé the journalists were, and this is nothing new. I mean, journalists in mainstream and otherwise have not been getting the undercurrents in this society forever, but my question was actually about what you think is going to happen now that the Perez was nominated to DNC chair, and whether you see the Democrats as shooting themselves in the foot again, and what can we do to push that to the left?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think you're absolutely right. I think the Democrats, first of all, they're clearly in schism. You know, they're the two camps. They have not had a rapprochement, you know, in any meaningful way. The sort of Bernie group and the Clinton Democrats still don't see eye to eye on a lot of major issues. And I think if you were to ask people who are, you know, in the Bernie camp, what the Democrats need to do to kind of get better again is that they need to rebrand themselves and find a message and a political purpose that resonates with ordinary people. You know, Trump has a message. Trump's message is, you know, I am an anti-globalist. I am going to be for you first. I'm going to put up a wall, and everybody on one side of the wall is the people who I'm going to take care of, and I'm not going to worry about the people on the other side. The Democrats don't have a message. Their message is Russia right now. And I think that's a mistake politically. Even if the Russia stuff is real, and I don't know about that, but even if it is, they still need to have a way to talk to ordinary people and say the Democrats are going to provide a solution to your problems, and we understand what you're going through. And they just are not doing that. They continue to think that this is a beltway issue that can be solved by some new rhetorical line that they can throw out, and they can triangulate their way back to victory. It just doesn't work like that. They lost the popularity contest to the most incompetent person in history. They should be scared by that.
Yeah, Matt, you're right about this. Can you talk just quickly, because we have a lot of phone calls, but what are your thoughts on what is happening with Russia? Just last week, Politico had a piece about how congressional Republicans killed a Democratic measure to pressure the administration to turn over documents detailing Trump's ties to Russia. How do you see all of this?
So, first of all, I lived in Russia for 10 years, so I have my own newspaper over there. I still have a lot of ties to Russian reporters. So we've all of us who worked over there, and all the reporters I know who are still over there, we talk with each other all the time about what all of this is about, and a lot of us are just perplexed. And my personal feeling is that this is a very dangerous story for both the Democratic Party and for the national media, because we have to rely upon a lot of unnamed sources that come from the intelligence agencies, and there's an awful lot of smoke and not a whole lot of fire. I mean, the things that we know concretely seem to be that General Flynn had a conversation with the Russian ambassador, and that the Russians appear to have hacked the DNC and probably gave that stuff, the material, to WikiLeaks. But beyond that, there's an awful lot of insinuation, and the reason I'm worrying about this story is because Donald Trump's emphases right now is to say that all of the criticism of him is fake news, where it mostly isn't. But if this story turns out to be anything less than what people are implying it is, then he will have a trump card for, sorry for the pun, but he'll be able to lord that over the media forever, and it could just, I worry that it could massively blow up in the Democrats' faces.
You also write in your book, this is probably one of my favorite lines, going back to Lisa's question about Dems, you write, the maddening thing about the Dems is that they refuse to see how easy they could have it. If the party threw its weight behind a truly populist platform, if it stood behind unions, prosecuted Wall Street criminals, stopped taking gobs of cash from every crooked transnational bank and job exporting manufacturer in the world, they would win every election season in a landslide.
Yeah, absolutely. And but the problem is that, and this gets back to the whole problem of how Washington operates. It's really a logistical problem. The people who get elected in this country, in order to get elected, you have to raise a lot of money. And when you're in the House especially, you have to keep raising money. Even after you've been elected, there's no break. It's not 6 years, it's 2 years. And how do you raise money? It's awfully hard to do if you don't have an easy source of cash. And what's happening is that the Democrats have become dependent particularly upon the financial services industry, which amounts to something like 30% to 40% of all donations. So they're not willing to give up the money. But the problem is, policy-wise, they can never really make inroads with ordinary people until they stop taking the money. And so that's the catch-22 that they just have to solve if they're going to go forward.
Matt Taibbi is author of the new book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. He's a contributing editor with Rolling Stone. And thanks for calling, Lisa. Let's go next to Ariana in Berkeley. Hi, Ariana. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm calling because when you ask Matt why Trump won, you know, I always get frustrated because he actually didn't win, first of all. He lost the popular vote by something like 3 million, which is very significant. So I think we have to, A, you know, explain and change the Electoral College, but also the whole structure of voter suppression in this country and gerrymandering by the Republicans. I mean, the Democrats are never going to win again as long as those structures are not changed. So I feel that we have to address that. And I kind of get frustrated when progressives just sort of give in to the notion that Trump won because he actually didn't win. And right there, if we give in, we lose that.
Well, yes, he lost by 3 million popular by votes, and 90 million people did not vote. But what about that, Matt, gerrymandering? I mean, we've done so many shows about gerrymandering. You don't really hear Democrats talk about this, although now Tom Perez says we need to be in every state across the country. He kind of sounds like Howard Dean when he talked about the 50-state strategy all over again in 2017.
Yeah. Well, just first of all, getting to Ariana's question, respectfully, I kind of have to disagree. I think Trump did win. I mean, unless we're talking about illegal voter suppression affecting the vote counts in the states, which, from what I understand, there is a story there, and that has to be investigated. But the fact that he lost the popular vote doesn't mean anything. The system that we have is the system that we have, and he won according to that system. And the saying that he didn't win, I think it provides too easy an out for the Democratic Party. This should never have been close. Mm. To lose to somebody like Trump, for Trump to even be within 10 or 15 million votes of anybody, is an extraordinary indictment of the unpopularity of the Democratic Party as a whole. And I think to sort of cling to the idea that, well, we won the popular vote, or if the Comey thing hadn't happened, or if Russia hadn't interfered, that allows the party to not look itself in the mirror and say, what did we do wrong? And they did an awful lot that was wrong. And they're paying for not having delivered for over a course of many, many years.
What are your thoughts about how the Dems are answering the question about why they lost? They, like you said, they're pointing at everyone else. Tom Perez finally said one of the reasons is because Hillary Clinton told people not to vote for Donald Trump, but didn't tell people why they should vote for her.
Right, and that was sort of a belated admission. If you read the stories, and I talked to people in D.C. in the week after the election, I continually heard the same thing, was that people within the campaign were frustrated because in their exit interviews, what all they were hearing was it was Russia, it was Comey, it was the media, it was all of these things. It was voter suppression. They won, or it was, we won the popular vote, but none of it was we ran a bad campaign, we didn't pick the right candidate, we made a bad decision to close the field at the start of the primary season, which I think was catastrophic. They didn't pay attention to the fact that there was this incredible trend where people wanted something new and were rejecting the system, and instead they picked somebody who was known primarily for being associated with the system for decades. And that's not a knock on Hillary Clinton, it's just that's where the electorate was, and they didn't listen. So I think they need to start, you know, honestly looking themselves in the mirror about what happened.
And 5 million people who voted for Obama did not vote.
Right. And Barack Obama himself, after the election, made a lot of really important points. One of the things that he said was, you know, even in the places where I knew I wasn't going to win, I campaigned, because there's a difference between losing by 10 points and losing by 30 points. These votes all count. So Obama campaigned in a lot of places where the Democrats didn't campaign the last couple of years. The Clinton strategy, unfortunately, was very heavily based on fundraising, media ad buys, and legacy media. So it was commercials and appearances on Meet the Press, and that's how they chose to reach out to people. It wasn't, you know, Trump's approach was exactly the opposite. He focused heavily on personal appearances, on stadium speeches, and he connected with people on a personal level, whereas the Democrats were never able to do that.
Let's go next to Mark in San Rafael. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Matt, I'm a huge fan. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks, Mark.
I'm wondering the extent to which President Trump's comments about fake media and indicting the press have had a chilling effect on you and other journalists and the way you do your work.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for that. It doesn't have a chilling effect on me because, you know, I think I have kind of a different job than most of the people who cover the White House. But it would certainly have an effect on somebody who, for instance, was in the White House press pool and had relied upon access to the government and to the White House to do their jobs well. And what Trump is essentially saying now is, if you don't write good things about me, you're out. You're not going to get anything from us, and it's hard to do your job as a White House reporter if you don't have access to the president. Now, somebody like me, that doesn't matter because they never talk to me. They're not going to. I always approach it from the outside. But the press now, and in a way, I think it's actually kind of a good thing. They're going to have to sort of get used to the idea that they're not behind the rope line with the people in power anymore. And that might be okay. You know, the appropriate posture of the media is to be on the outside. We should be antagonistic, and I think that's all right.
Last night at the speech, Donald Trump recognized Kerry Owens, whose husband, William Ryan Owens, was killed in Yemen. And the camera was on her, if anyone didn't watch it on TV, for a good, 2 to 3 minutes. She was crying, really crying. And Van Jones, who's an analyst on CNN, said, quote, "He became president of the United States in that moment, period." Mm-hmm. And we have a couple of emails about this. One listener says, "What are your thoughts on normalizing Trump, evidenced by the embarrassing observation by Van Jones on CNN last night? It seems like the media, rather than holding his feet to the fire, are toning down their criticisms." We have a few emails like that.
Right. Well, I didn't see the Jones clip, to be honest, but the criticism that the media is normalizing Trump, there's probably something to that. I think one of the things that is clear, and I look at things like the slate of nominees that he has appointed, and you mentioned it before, a great many of them, their only qualification seems to be their open hostility to the missions of the departments that they've were chosen to lead. I look at Trump as a revolutionary figure who really is, you know, as his advisor Steve Bannon says, looking to sort of deconstruct the administrative state from the inside. I think he's extraordinarily dangerous. But the problem is we have a system of media that's sort of used to the convention of the presidency and used to reporting on it in a certain way. And in the past, doing something like that, having an effective emotional display that connected with people and made for good television, yeah, that would make a presidency. But this is not a normal presidency. I think you have to keep your eyes on the ball mm-hmm. with Trump, and it's very difficult to do. To avoid the cliches that we've become accustomed to using when we cover presidential power.
Yeah, it's very difficult to do if you're not reading about these things all day, if this is not your job to actually follow what's really happening behind the scenes. So to that point, Matt, what are you watching right now that's maybe not getting much attention?
Well, again, it's not so much what I'm watching, but it's what I'm kind of not watching. Trump has one of the things that he does that's so effective is that he creates these hurricanes of misdirection constantly. You have to be checking Twitter every 5 minutes to find out which person he started a flame war with today. I mean, it could be Sweden today, it's Australia tomorrow, it's Saturday Night Live the next day, it's Meryl Streep after that. And the media is fanning out in all directions, covering all of these angles and reporting all this to death, and it creates this gigantic kind of cloud of stuff that makes it impossible for people to fight through and see what the essence of his presidency really is. And, you know, so far, you just have to focus on the real things that are actually going on. And that includes, you know, as you said, nominating these specific people to these specific agencies, things like the executive orders that have already, you know, really begun to take effect. And that's what you got to focus on. You know, what are they actually doing policy-wise, as opposed to all of this crazy soap opera nonsense that is generating ratings and attention.
Hmm. We have another email from a listener who says, this kind of discussion is the reason why the working class and middle America voted for Trump. You keep asking the inane question, why can't the Democrats do this or that? Why don't they have a message? And she writes, because the Dems are the very crowd that gave us this corrupt, evil mess. Under neoliberalism, the Dems have destroyed any and all of what once made this country livable for the working class and middle America. She writes about NAFTA, Clinton's third way in economics, big pharma, big ag, the list goes on. And you write about this in a lot of your columns.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say is I don't limit that to the Democrats. I mean, were the Republicans really any better on any of those issues? I think they're relatively the same. I mean, I covered the financial services industry and Wall Street for most of the last 8 years. You know, when I'm not doing campaigns, that's my normal beat. And, you know, the Republicans had basically an equal hand in a lot of the corruption that went on, you know, in the last 15 to 20 years that led to things like the 2008 crash. You know, but the Democrats also had a hand in it. You know, they were involved in things like repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, passing the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which deregulated derivatives. You know, their failure to enforce mortgage fraud and to regulate, you know, things like companies like AIG. All of that, yeah. I mean, the Democrats are guilty for all of that, but so are the Republicans. And I think what Trump, one of the reasons that he was successful is that he was the first candidate who was really able to say both parties are complicit and you need to pick someone who's not a politician if you want real change.
Matt Taibbi is author of the book Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt is an award-winning journalist with Rolling Stone. Matt, thanks so much for joining us and thanks for your reporting.
Thanks for having me on, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for your emails and your phone calls. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy is assistant producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.